Well, hello everybody, greetings parishioners, and welcome to this our inaugural podcast for all things Rocking Vicar. I trust you'll bear with us if things are not exactly up to Radio 4 standards, because we're new to all this, and I have to admit, spent at least 2 hours trying to make the technology work. But we are here, we are with you, and also with us is Terence Dacom. Hello, sir.
Hello there, you all right?
Yes, how are you?
It's going terribly well. I understand these podcasts are, you know, it could be the future, and I'm glad we're in at the very beginning.
Yes, nobody's ever done one of these before, have
no,
they?
No, apparently not, and, you know, I feel there could be a future to this. I don't know, you know.
Yes, I feel like Marconi or somebody, mm. as opposed to Marconi.
Yes.
Anyway, as you entered the studio clutching a large tumbler of scotch, you mentioned to me that you had some important health and safety news, so I think we should do that without further delay.
I wish I had a jingle, Magnus. Oh, yeah, health and safety news. But yeah, health and safety news I thought would be a good starting point because, you know, it's important for all of us.
And yeah, indeed, yes.
Yeah, and I noticed this week that there's been two major stories that, you know, really got a lesson for all of us here, I think, really. And from the Telegraph in the week, fantastic story, teenagers in Easter bunny outfits were turned away from a zoo because of fears they would cause psychological damage to the animals. And this is actually a true story. Edinburgh Zoo. And there's this photograph in the Telegraph of these like five teenagers. They're sort of 15 years old, and they're wearing what, frankly, has to be said, rather poor bunny outfits. Essentially, they're wearing grey fleeces with a sort of grey hood, okay, where a couple of ears have been added on. But they were turned away because, oh, by the way, four of them were bunnies and one of them was a chicken. But again, his chicken outfit, I mean, this fellow, he's wearing a green polo shirt and jeans, and he's got like a green blanket shrouded round him with a bit of sort of orange on the top, I think, okay, denoting a beak. But Miss Gibson, who was one of the bunnies, was very distressed because they went to the ticket desk, and to cut what appears to be a very long story short, they were turned away by the zoo because, as Rachel Goddard, the spokeswoman for the zoo, said, there's very real evidence that humans in costume can cause distress to some of the zoo animals. Now, frankly, okay, I would have thought being cooped up behind, you know, sort of bars in a sort of like 10-foot by 10-foot kind of cell might be more distressing to some of the animals. The zoo, in fact, particularly thought that the chimpanzees would get very anxious and disturbed.
Yes, because I was going to say, surely the lions would look on and think little more than large dinner this evening.
You would think so, but yes, there we are. Poor old Miss Gibson, unable to visit the zoo over Easter because she was wearing essentially what is a grey fleece with a grey hood on the top and a couple of bits of sort of flappy greyness coming out of the hood. So that's health and safety news number one.
Great. I will cancel my trip to the zoo this afternoon dressed as a panda forthwith.
Don't even try it because of the distress and the anxiety that you could bring to the animals as they pace up and down in their 10-foot by 10.
Yes, that's the last thing I would want to do. But talking about alarm and distress, yes, I hear tales of zombies returning from the grave to walk the earth, and you amongst them.
I will tell you all about my zombie adventures after I've given you second piece. I mean, let's not get ahead of ourselves. I've got a second piece of health and safety news. I'm sorry to
forgive me.
Sorry about this, but there's more important issues. I'm okay with zombies.
Right.
If you're going to Butlins this year, which I'm sure, you know, most weekends, I'm sure that's where
I have it in mind. I have it in mind.
And you have a go on the bumper cars at Butlins this year. And there's three Butlin resorts left now, by the way, Bognor, Minehead and Skegness.
Okay.
You're getting on the bumper cars. What's the one thing that you think they're there for? What are you going to do when you get in those bumper cars? What's the plan?
Well, I would say, I'm probably going to throw a spanner in the works here, yeah, because I would say the plan is to complete as many circuits of the rink as, yeah, you can without being struck by another car. But other people might disagree with that.
you're the perfect customer.
I thought so, yes.
Butlin's motif. Because Butlin's are now saying that you cannot bump into other people in the bumper cars.
Yeah.
There's going to be signs up saying no bumping, and you've got to drive around slowly in circles rather than crash into anyone else for fear of an injury that could result in the resort being sued. Health and safety news, Magnus. It's, as we will say when I find these stories, it's health and safety gone mad.
Yes, indeed. I think that this legislation may well be drawn up by my dear mother, who, when I was a child, informed me quite vociferously that they are not bumper cars, they are dodgems. The clue's in the name. You must dodge the other cars in order to complete circuits of the ring. And so perhaps she is behind this.
I fear your mother has indeed been working as a consultant to Sir Billy Butlin's organisation, because it's all about whiplash.
Yes.
You get.
This wouldn't surprise me. This wouldn't surprise me. My mother is involved in no end of nefarious activities.
Health and safety news.
Health and safety news. And I thought I would just mention, actually, I'm doing some extra parish activity in glorious Salford Quays at the moment. And my office overlooks the legendary and the controversial Media City development. And I've seen this, it's almost finished now. There are builders still there, but there are also BBC staff arriving aplenty. But I was reading today that some of the people, senior management, let's call them, at the BBC, who were very evangelical about this project when it was first mooted, are now the ones staying behind in London. Did you read this?
I did. Richard Devereaux is the latest BBC high of the hierarchy of the BBC.
Indeed.
To say, what a great idea this Salford operation is, but by the way, I'm staying in London.
Yes.
Last August, in fact, he said, my job is in Salford. That's the biggest and most exciting thing happening in the BBC. And Peter Salmon, the director of BBC North, who's also actually not going, said, oh, Richard's been critical in the creation of BBC North, an untiring advocate. Unfortunately, now he's leaving his job as chief operating officer of BBC North and looking after BBC property in West London.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Is that like doormats and biros?
I suspect so. I think he may be very much in charge of waste paper bins and so on. When you say you're seeing these hordes of people emerging into Media City, are you sure they're BBC employees and not an estate looking to convert the building into rather tidy apartments?
There are plenty of tidy apartments sort of between Media City and where my office is. But I am sure there are BBC people there, for they all sport rather snazzy BBC pendants, laminates. So they're definitely BBC people there, although I suspect they are sort of ground troops rather than any sort of semblance of management. What I would say about the Media City thing is, I mean, quite apart from the debate as to whether the BBC needs to be in the north or not, which is perhaps for another podcast, is I think what people don't appreciate is that it's rather tremendous. I mean, I've been to the various BBC buildings in London at various points, and this looks much nicer, it has to be said. Salford Quays is quite a terrific development, and I think, given the opportunity and relocation aside, I would rather be turning up there for work every morning than, say, Wood Lane, which is a bit of a relic.
But then, on the other hand, looking at your Twitter feed,
yes,
and your journey that you sometimes relate from the outskirts of the Northwest into Salford.
Yes, via the auspices of the Rocking Vicar, of course. He relays my Twitter messages.
So I believe.
Yes.
I understand that those that are taking that huge step up north may not find the transport links quite to their liking. So you say that about Wood Green and White City, but the tubes are pretty regular, and you know you can get there reasonably within the time that you're hoping for. But your history has been not quite that up there.
You are right there. I have to say the trams out to Salford from central Manchester are the toy town would be the phrase that sprang to mind. A couple of interesting, stunningly fascinating facts about the Manchester tram system. Two trams cannot pass while in motion on certain stretches, which causes some interesting journeys whilst we wait for a tram that's in motion to come past us.
You see, I simply can't understand that. As a tram layman, I would expect a tram could overtake, because don't they go along? They go along on a track, don't they? And they're powered by lines from above.
So how, that's right. Yeah, that's correct. Yeah.
So how could you overtake? You're on a rail with a line above. How could you overtake that?
Mr. Decom. Trams go in two directions, there and back.
Yes.
Yes, simultaneously. So there's two lines.
There's two.
I see what you mean. They're not trying to share a line. No. It's just not safe on corners, on sharp corners, for two trams to take that corner at the same time in opposite directions in motion.
Oh, okay. All right.
less an episode of Coronation Street springs to life before your eyes. So.
Yes. So. Yeah. Okay. So that's Salford. And you're going to keep your eyes very firmly on that for us.
I will be the vicar's man in Salford, bringing you all the latest developments as BBC execs singularly fail to show up. Yes.
I tell you, I know it's for another day, but I absolutely swear, if they could, if it wasn't such a PR disaster, I reckon they'd get out now if they could. And those studios would be now... panoramic apartments for the cognoscenti of...
I think you're probably right, but my take on that would be it would be a shame, but we will return to this subject.
We will. You were going to ask me about my life as a zombie.
Well, yeah, well, whilst we're talking about broadcast productions, you like the way all this seamlessly links together? It's quite rather clever, isn't it?
I've learnt a lesson there. That was magnificent.
I've got that, yeah. You have been part of... quite on paper at least, a striking television production, haven't you, called... Can we say the name?
We can.
Okay, now what's it called?
Cockneys versus Zombies, and it's not
Cockneys
a television production.
Versus Zombies.
It's a movie. It's the big world of cinema.
Oh, it's silver screen, is it?
It's a silver screen.
Oh, my... I do you a disservice, sir.
You did indeed. It's a reasonably big budget for a British movie, and a stellar cast. We've got Honor Blackman, Rasmus Hardiker.
Bond girl, no less.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Pussy Galore in the Bond films. Richard Briers. Alan...
Never a Bond girl, Richard Briers.
No, that's true. For many a role over the years, but not a Bond girl.
Okay.
Yes, and Alan Ford, Tony Selby. So quite a cast, and it's been enormous fun. I'm going to sound like the most appalling prima donna, because, you know, anybody who works, I don't know, digging roads or doing any sort of manual work will think, oh, yes, a poor fellow. But, you know, it's been really long days. You know, it's been a minimum of 12-hour days. The call sheet's been getting us in for about 6 o'clock in the morning on location in South London, and then 12 hours. You know, unless you've ever done anything like this, I can hear the audience now. I can say, oh, poor fellow, you know.
Yes, so we'll put in a call to privatise Lovey's column any moment.
Exactly. But it's actually extraordinarily wearying just hanging around endlessly, because you have to be on set, on location. You have to be ready to be called at any moment. So you're kind of flicking through a newspaper, you're chatting and so on, and then you get called, and then it's like a big buzz, and you've got your... couple of minutes of action, and you do it sort of 10 times, and then you come away, and then you're sitting around again for another.
Is this Charlie Watts syndrome then? Where Charlie Watts famously said that being in the Rolling Stones has been like 5 years of gigging and 25, probably more now, 25 years of waiting around.
Absolutely. That came to mind very much, old Charlie's comment. But having said that, yeah, of course, you know, it's been enormous fun. We've just come to the end of it, the end of filming. It's today. There's some late scenes being filmed, but it's been done over 6 and 7 weeks, all apart from the studio work and locations around London. And it's been enormous fun. There was a plan to. I was playing a zombie, by the way, just in case anyone thought I was playing a Cockney.
Typecasting, I think they call that.
Undoubtedly. Many would say that I didn't have to spend too long in makeup. But the makeup girls were absolutely fantastic because we had to be covered, quite frankly, in blood. And in later scenes, after a dramatic moment, which I better not go into for spoilers reasons, and covered in glass as well. So,
wow.
But the makeup girls, they seriously have been the best makeup girls I've ever seen on a set. They were just tremendous, and the authenticity of it was superb. I think I posted a few photos on Twitter, and I actually felt in the end as the gore got worse and worse through the weeks that I couldn't post these photos anymore, because I thought if somebody just clicked on it and came across it, just go, oh my god,
you know, they think you'd been unwell.
Well, honestly, we had some great fun on location. It's terrible, really, but
I don't know film sets well at all, what I do know is advertising agencies, and in an advertising agency over the years, I've developed a theory that it doesn't matter who you upset or who you're particularly brusque with, as long as it is not the girl on reception. And I figure that makeup girls are probably the same. They're sort of the throbbing heart of the operation.
Yeah, absolutely right. There's three sets of people not to upset on a movie or TV set. One is the makeup girls. The second is any of the assistant directors. And probably just ahead in terms of importance is the catering people, because, yes. You know, they and you don't want to upset them either. Otherwise, you know, you'll be at the end of the queue and getting the sort of last bits of stale bread. Not that there are any, because the catering is superb. But no, the makeup girls are super fantastic. And what I was just going to say was we had a kind of what you call like base camp, where all the makeup and the caravans for the, you know, where the stars hang out. Needless to say, I didn't have a trailer, and the catering and the wardrobe and, you know, all the sort of basics. But the actual location where we were filming was about two streets away. And to get us back and forth was quite a major operation. All the technical crew, the makeup, the people, the actors, and again, all the sort of peripheral people. So there was a few of us that thought, well, you know, we won't wait for cars or minibuses. We'll just walk. And this, of course, as you can imagine, in full zombie makeup with blood streaming down our faces and in some cases bits of glass embedded in our heads, caused great concern for the local people in the area in South London, many of whom... It transpired. We weren't able to walk from base to location after a day or two because of the interest it caused in the local emergency services.
Oh, but listen, Mr. Decombe, I'm not buying that at all. I've lived in South London for many years, and people walking past covered in blood and broken glass is a common occurrence.
No.
Nobody turns a hair, surely.
Well, if you see some of the photos, maybe we can get one up on the side or something. Honestly, people were lovely. People were coming across. There was two or three of us who walked the couple of streets for the first couple of days. And Honestly, people were coming up and saying, are you okay? Is everything all right? God, what's right. You? Seriously.
Well, that's good. It's good to know that there was some concern there. But...
And I promise you, on my word, that an ambulance was called by a member of
the public, really?
Because they were so concerned about this person wandering along the road,
wow.
drenched in what in fact was corn syrup, red corn syrup.
Yes.
But it was
yes.
fantastically, just spot on. It felt like it looked like, I'm afraid, hemoglobin.
Because in the days of Hammer, this used to be known as Kensington Gore, didn't it?
Oh, very good.
Did you not know that? That's the Hammer technicians referred to the fake blood as Kensington Gore.
Excellent, didn't they?
But what you were sporting probably wasn't Kensington Gore. The interesting thing about Kensington Gore was to get any kind of possibility of distribution in the UK in the sort of 60s and 70s or 50s and 60s probably for a horror film it had to be clear that what you were seeing was fake blood. So when you watch the old Christopher Lee Peter Cushing Hammer movies, the blood is wildly unrealistic. And that's not because they couldn't create that deep crimson colour. It's because they purposely had to go for a more vivid red that looked more like paint, because that was as far as they were allowed to go. They had to intentionally make the blood look unbloody so as not to upset the audience and get a certificate, albeit an X certificate.
Oh, well, my giddy aunt, that was here. That certainly won't be the case here. The blood is incredibly realistic.
It is
a comedy, I should stress. It's a sort of comedy horror. It's light-hearted. It's not going to be all Kensington Gore. It's fun in it as well. I'll just say that it's not. I'm not plugging it at all because it's not due out. It was hoped to get it out in time for Halloween, but apparently that's going to be problems with distribution, so it probably won't appear on the silver screen, as you so kindly put it, until about February of next year. But the last bit I'll say about it is one thing to look out for when it does come out. It's got a really good chase scene in it because, again, without giving spoilers away, there's a chase scene.
No, hold on. Chase scene? Now, if there's one thing I know about zombies is these fellows and ladies of the undead tend to perambulate with some caution. They don't move particularly quickly.
It's the slowest chase scene ever seen on cinema, I imagine, because we've got an elderly person with a Zimmer frame. And again, it's one of the stars, but I won't say which one, is attempting to escape from a zombie or a couple of zombies, and there will be chase music added on, the dun 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 dun, and the person with the Zimmer frame is moving almost at negative speed, and the zombie equally at zombie speed, and it works really well. It's a really funny clip, so that'll be worth looking out for. So that has been my glittering, in fact, movie career.
Well, how fantastic. We must get some stills of you in full garb upon the site. That's a pledge. We will do that.
Okay.
Yeah. Fantastic. Also on the site, I'm getting really good at these seamless links. Also, talking about pictures on the site, on the homepage this week, we have our top 10 Wills and Kates.
Oh no! Okay, right.
From the world of music and media, and there's a reason for that which almost slips my mind, but I have a vague recollection that yesterday something occurred that was vague national interest, slight national interest, and that was the royal wedding.
I loved it, but can I just ask you, Wills and Kates? I do hope Kate Bush is featured.
You'll have to visit the site, sir. But I think you can hang your hat on that.
Yeah, I think that's a given, isn't it? Yeah, it was fantastic yesterday, the royal wedding. I loved it, and I'm not ashamed to say so. I thought Hugh Edwards, I watched it all on BBC. Other people were saying on Twitter, oh, ITV coverage is great, and Sky were there as well, of course, and in HD all over the place. But
yeah, and the rest of the world, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. 2 billion, I believe, is the estimate.
So you might have to take that up with Dara O'Brien, who's been tweeting furiously that this is a totally spurious figure put together from potential audiences rather than recorded, because they were saying it was 2 billion before the event.
Here we go. You see, he's another misery, much like himself. knocking the royals. But I thought Hugh Edwards did a great job, and I really think he now is probably the last in the line of these sort of broadcasters who particularly specialise in what I think we can call a state occasion. A long line of, and he's fantastic because he anchored it all day, and I thought he was wonderfully relaxed and calm, but just brought us into the action. But the best thing he did, Magnus, the best thing Hugh Edwards did in this coverage was he knew when to keep quiet. And that's the key.
Yes.
He knew when to shut up and just let the action, unfurl. And that was the case with pretty much all of the ceremony. We didn't need a commentary, and he didn't give it. And for that, a big tip of the hat.
Well, that is the art of any commentary, isn't it? I think it's almost a forgotten art, but it is certainly essential for any commentary, isn't it?
I'm still learning that art, when to keep quiet. And the other positive, which I'm going to go totally against the tide here, because again, these days, of course, Twitter is our friend to find out the national mood. And there was a great deal of dismay that Fern Cotton from what I believe you young people call Radio 1 was featured as an on-the-spot reporter. I thought she did fine. For what she was asked to do, she was outside the palace, she was doing vox pops, and as we know, they're sort of minefields of danger. I thought she did great.
Right. Don't get me started on the subject of Fern Cotton, for that is certainly for another day. I didn't see her vox pops, her out and about stuff. I do recall her doing something similar at Live 8, and it was excruciating, but perhaps she has improved.
I remember the Live 8 interviews as well, and that was a bit sort of gigglesome and fluttery, but this was fine. The downside for me from all broadcasters was this reliance on, particularly in the build-up, of running out of things to say and do, and so the fallback position was, well, let's go and see what some of the crowd make of it all. And unfortunately, unless you've had a chat with the people beforehand and look, I'm going to ask you this, what are you going to say, which maybe pulling down that sort of curtain between people's expectations of spontaneity. But really, I think you've got to do that, because if you just plonk a microphone in front of people who aren't expecting it, either they freeze or they go giggly or they say something inappropriate. And we got all of that in the run-up.
But this, because there was too much coverage. It started too early and extended too far beyond the closing events. Inevitably, that leads to padding, and padding is always poor. And I just think, clearly it had to be covered as a national event, but they're still covering it this morning.
I'm sure they are. Yes, well, I totally agree with you on that aspect. And, similarly, and I think it sort of ties in with this, over the last couple of years of watching sport, live sport, and particularly football, I've given myself a rule, and I've stuck by it, and it's worked superbly well, not to watch all the preamble and the post-game analysis, because it's always just so full of fluff, as you say, with this. And I think that would have been a good rule for me, and indeed it seems you yesterday, which was to have not watched the build-up. But, it was good and part of the coverage to see the princes William and Harry sort of leaving Clarence House, and Catherine Middleton leaving the Goring Hotel, who, by the way, will never ever need to advertise ever again.
Surely not, no.
But unfortunately, as you infer, in between those little short, sharp bits of activity came endless conversations with the retired major this. And rather oddly, I felt, for the BBC, although he was very good, but they relied on him too heavily. Simon Sharma, the history fellow,
sure,
was in the studio with our Hugh. And we kept going to him, and also some chap who'd been on the inside of the royal household.
Sharma must have had a sleeping bag in the.
I thought you were going to break into song there when you went Sharma Sharma. I thought you were going to chameleon.
Please, he must have had some kind of a fold-out camp bed at the BBC, because he was on air at 8 o'clock this morning talking about the self same thing. So I can't believe he even went home.
Yeah, I just thought there might have been a few other interesting experts, if we could call them that, that might have added a further twist to our enlightenment. But overall, I found it really, it was a lovely day. And, you know, I would say to the naysayers and Republicans,
to me
and to you, Magnus, frankly, yes, you know, it was good just to enjoy a sort of national day of happiness, really. You know, it's again, I'm going to sound like an old granddad here. There's so much going on in the world. But, you know, there's lots of horrid things going on in the world, and we don't ignore that. And, you know, we know that there's worrying times all around the world at the moment. But it was good just to have a few hours of seeing, you know, a couple of people just having a cracking day. And, you know, we were all part of it. And I did indeed get rather tearful at certain parts of it. I'm sure I was alone.
That speaks volumes for your sensitivity. I'm not going to get into the whole Republican rants because...
We'll be here till midnight, yes.
Yes, that's probably for another time. So let me tell you what I did for the royal wedding. I had lunch at Café Rouge in Sheffield, who weren't broadcasting it in any shape, way or form, and then dived into the cinema next door and watched the Red Riding Hood reimagining movie that is out at the moment, which is has been made in the hope that nobody remembers Neil Jordan's Company of Wolves from the 80s, because it's almost exactly the same film, but not quite as good. But that freed me from the wedding to a greater extent. My nearest and dearest did insist on watching the bit in the church before we went to the cinema. And actually, so I can, with some confidence, give you a highlight. The highlights of the whole thing, from what I saw of it, for me, took a fraction of a second, and it was as William and Catherine arrived at the altar. The very second they were both at the altar, the BBC cut to an overhead shot, which must have been buried high in the rafters of Westminster Abbey, to give a perfectly symmetrical shot of everybody's heads, and it was right down onto their heads, and it just created a sort of pattern. I don't know if you noticed that. It just looked like an abstract pattern, but it was actually the very overhead shot from the ceiling of the Westminster Abbey down onto the altar. What a stroke of genius, stroke of television directorial genius. I thought that was absolutely great, just from a technical point of view. What a terrific stroke of inspiration to give us that shot for about 3/4 of a second before that was just terrific. The rest of it, just for the birds, as far as I was concerned. But I thought that was a great piece of directing.
It was a great shot.
Yeah.
It made me feel, what's the thing when you're up high and you get
vertigo?
It gave me a burst of vertigo.
Absolutely.
I felt a bit scared up there. And I thought, oh, I'm going to fall. It was a great shot. And the good thing was, as well, they didn't linger on it, as you say. It lasted for a fraction of a second.
Absolutely. Now, probably took several hours to set up for a fraction of a second.
Absolutely.
And, you know, I think that's probably what you get from the BBC, is you get that attention to detail. And they will spend a few hours setting up a shot that lasts 3/4 of a second. And good on them for that, because it really works. I thought, you know, for a live broadcast with unimaginable things going on behind the scenes, that was a stroke of genius.
Now, Magnus Shaw, I don't have your remarkable skills for linking one item to another, as will become immediately apparent.
Okay.
So I'm going to surprise you now. I've got a surprise for you. And I notice you've gone particularly quiet. with concern. I've got a quiz for you. If we survive more than one podcast, this could become something of...
Not a regular feature.
Could be an in-and-out feature, depending on whether I can be asked, whether I can find the material.
Sounds like cue for another jingle, though.
It is, in fact, cue for another jingle. And this is the jingle, and it is prog or poem, prog or poem.
Ah.
Is this prog or is it a poem? What I'm going to do is read you three pieces of prose.
Right.
And you've got to decide whether this each piece of prose is either a piece from a poem from very well-known classical poem history, or whether it is lyrics from a well-known prog rock classic.
Okay?
There's going to be three of them. So, as in all of the best quiz shows, you have to get two out of three to win the non-existent prize.
I am ready for the challenge.
Prog or poem, that is your challenge.
Okay. And
of the three examples, here comes number one. You simply have to tell me and the audience whether you believe this is prog or poem. Are you ready for the first piece of prose?
Shoot.
I'm shooting. And some in dreams assured were of the spirit that played us so. 9 fathom deep he had followed us from the land of mist and snow. Magna Shaw, prog or poem?
Well, land of mist and snow talks to me of tales of topographic oceans and Knights of the Round Table. So I'm going to say it's prog.
You're saying that's prog?
Mm.
I'm afraid that is the wrong answer. That was from the Rhyme of the Mariner.
Really? Curses.
Samuel Taylor Coleridge,
indeed.
1798.
A little early for to appear on Yes albums, I fear.
I thought it was more Zeppelin-esque, you know, the land of the mist and snow, whatever.
Yes,
yeah.
No quarter, it might have been No Quarter, but anyway.
Yeah, I could see where you went wrong there, but went wrong you did, and I'm afraid you've got off to a very poor start.
Well,
you
need
to get both of the last two now to win the non-existent prize. Magna Shaw, are you ready for your second clip?
Hit me.
I'm hitting. Talking to the trees of the cobweb, strange, sleeping on the steps of a fountain, waving silver wands to the nightbird's song, waiting for the sun on the mountain.
Well, that's awful. So I do hope it's not one of our great poets, because I thought that was rotten. So I think that must be prog.
Magna Shaw, you're saying prog. You're correct.
Oh.
That is prog. It's one all. That was from Moonchild in the Court of the Crimson King.
Yes.
In Crimson. And written by the gifted, though not in your view because you said it was awful, Pete Sinfield, who we hope will never hear this, and he wrote that in 1969.
In 1969 it probably sounded terrific.
Everything Magna Shaw is on your last answer. It's 1-1 between prog and poem.
Right.
Here comes your third and final clip. Is it prog or is it poem? Man alone born of stone will stamp the dust of time. His hands strike the flame of his soul, ties a rope to a tree, and hangs the universe until the wind of laughter blows cold.
That's an improvement on the trees of the cobweb. I'd rather enjoyed that. I thought it was rather profound. Not that prog rock can't be profound, but I think
you're stalling. I hope you're not googling there.
I
hope you're not googling.
No, did you hear the tapping of a keyboard?
I did hear the tapping of a keyboard, but you're stalling. Have you got people there with you that you're sending out to the music stores to look up sheet music, or out to W.H. Smith to look at poetry compilations?
Funnily enough, I'm not. Therefore, I am going to plump for prose.
You're going for prose.
Mm.
Magnus Shaw. The last piece was, in fact, prog rock.
You lost
the petition. It was Carnival 9 by Emerson, Lake and Palmer from their top-selling album Brain Salad Surgery.
Yes.
Released in 1973. And again, the work of the much maligned, by Magnus Shaw, Pete Sinfield.
Well, he'd improved over the 4 years between the two pieces, is all I can say. Good on you, Pete. It's
very distressing that, someone with the qualifications such as yourself was unable to differentiate there. And I'm afraid you have not won this week's Star Prize. And if this becomes a series, then all we can do is hope that you can do better in the future.
Shameful. If some Hawkwind shows up, I'll be on a much more even keel. I can recite acres of Hawkwind lyrics.
The amazing thing with Pete Sinfield is... look at that. Now, look, seamless link there. Now, I learned something from you today.
You did.
The amazing...
That's my gift to you.
Well, thank you. The amazing thing with Pete Sinfield is, his early years, King Crimson, Emerson, Lake and Palmer... Bit of Roxy music, Keith Christmas.
Yes.
But then, who did he end up writing for in, I think it must have been the 80s, but none other than Five Star and Bucks Fizz.
Well,
he actually,
he's a man of many talents.
Isn't he just?
Yes. Did he do the Land of Make-Believe? He must have done that, surely.
I can't remember now. I'm sure... the listener may be able to help. He did do the Land of Make-Believe, now I remember. Because,
I think he did. Yeah.
Yes,
Good for him. He can spread himself thin, and that's always an admirable quality.
He moved on, didn't he?
Yes. Well, Mr. DeCombe, we've hit our 40-minute mark.
Lorks.
Which I think is the limit for these podcasts.
I believe it's all you're allowed the rules of podcast.
Yes.
Probably because it just about fits in nicely for a train journey or a walk in the park or a car journey or something.
Absolutely. So we must wrap, unfortunately. It's been an absolute pleasure to spend 40 minutes on a bank holiday Saturday afternoon in your company. I'm having a barbecue this evening. What are you doing this evening just before we go?
I will be watching Chelsea play Tottenham. In their hopes for just clinging on to the very outside chance of winning the Premiership, and also in a sport related day, watching the 2000 Guineas, in which Frankel is the favourite at Newmarket this afternoon. But I would say look out as an each way bet for Native Khan, 18-1 this morning. Probably won't beat Frankel, but good for an each way place. But never follow my tips. That's what I say.
Native Khan, of course, a lesser-known Emerson, Lake and Palmer album.
Yes, written by Pete Sinfield.
Absolutely. Well, once again, thanks very much for your company. And when we do further podcasts, we shall hope to have further guests with us. But for this week, it's just been me and thee. And it's been absolutely splendid. And I think I'm not pushing my neck out too far to say we'd like to dedicate this to the memory of polystyrene.